Well, I had a problem this week. I was really enjoying The Philosopher's Stone by Joseph Farrell, and then mysteriously in the mail, Nazi International showed up. And I got sidetracked with that. In the end, I never finished either book, but read deeply into both, loving the work. Can't wait to have the conversation about the Nazis' post-war plans and the history, the tradition of alchemy, and understanding both ancient alchemy in the way it was originally intended, and then later as it's understood through modern physics and the search for exotic matter, all coming up with Joseph Farrell next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Joseph Farrell, how do you find the time?
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me back on. Well, sometimes it's kind of difficult, I have to tell you.
I don't know. It's just it's the detail. It's the exhaustive, extensive attributions you make that this is not just something that you are putting together by going through and collating information that you've gleaned off the internet.
Well, right. It is kind of an interesting thing that I try and do. I do try and reference very thoroughly, and in all my books, I realize I'm putting together argued cases or speculative cases, and when I do that, I do try and clue the readership in that that's what I'm trying to do. But they are referenced rather thoroughly, as you know, and they kind of dovetail into each other. So yeah, it's time consuming work, that's for sure.
Well, that's the interesting part, and let's run through some of the titles people might have heard of in the past. Reich of the Black Sun, the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, Secrets of the Unified Field, Nazi International, the Nazis' post-war plan to control finance, conflicts, physics, and space. Also, the New Philosopher's Stone, which we'll talk more about. When you talk about how they dovetail into each other, yeah, you're writing speculative work here, but you lock it down with so many of these poles along the way. I mean, they're signposts that let you know that although we may be heading off into uncharted territory, this is not an unresearched map. It's just you take it maybe a couple of steps further than other people do.
Well, yeah, and I like the analogy of a map and signposts, because these are kind of dangerous waters, and I think it's helpful to the reader, too, to be able to see where I'm pulling some of this from and see the actual documents and be able to read them so that they can kind of find their way forward from there. And I do know that there are people that kind of use my books as launching posts for their own research, so that's kind of why I do it.
Yeah, I like the fact, too, that I believe you referenced Jim Mars in the opening of The Philosopher's Stone. And of course, he's a friend of the show, and I love reading his stuff too. And you dovetail a little bit with his work, but you know, you head off in a different direction than Jim does, but it's interesting to see how you kind of overlap a little bit.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, I kind of bump into a lot of researchers. I bump into Jim Mars and what he's researching a lot. We kind of back into each other. I bump into Richard Hoagland and some of his research and Mike Barrett's research a lot. And it's kind of interesting when you do it, because we all work independently and we're coming up to, you know, to similar conclusions. So it's kind of stimulating in that respect as well.
Yeah, but it's still a fairly small club. You know,
oh, yeah.
I mean, if you guys got together for McMuffins, you pretty much get by on one table, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So then let's broaden this out a little bit and say, instead of just focusing on the Philosopher's Stone, which we could, maybe we roll a couple of big boulders here at the beginning before we get down to cases. And let's talk about the history of alchemy so people understand some of the terms we're talking about. It's a word that gets used a lot, but not necessarily in the same way that we're going to be talking about it.
Well, alchemy is a very, very interesting thing. You know, it's usually classified as a pseudoscience, but, you know, as we get into this, we're going to see some things that do raise some eyebrows. But historically, it's thought that alchemy begins with either Egypt or China, possibly both. I'm kind of in the camp that probably both countries and civilizations contributed their own unique aspects to the science. But basically, the idea of alchemy is, of course, to come up with something called the Philosopher's Stone. And what the Philosopher's Stone is in the popular imagination is basically the idea that you can take base metals like tin or lead or things like that, iron even in some cases, and then transmute it or turn it into gold, into actual real gold. Well, that's kind of the exoteric aspect of alchemy, the public consumption version of it, and that's certainly true. You can read alchemical texts and you'll find references to these types of operations over and over again. But there's kind of another aspect of alchemy, the esoteric aspect, which I think is really the fascinating story here, because the real roots of this belief in transmutation lie in what the ancient Egyptian alchemists and medieval alchemists understood about the nature of the physical medium, or if you prefer, space-time. When I use the phrase physical medium, that's basically what I'm talking about. So what they believed, in essence, was that this physical medium had real existence, okay, but it did not have any differentiation. In other words, you could not distinguish things within it. It was just one kind of big all-encompassing thing. But in the process of creation, this medium undergoes differentiation. So in other words, what they believed was that all of creation itself had some direct link to that physical medium. And what alchemy was then was it was in kind of a sense an attempt to back engineer or reverse engineer the descent of an individual creature from that medium so that you could transmute it into something else. And thus, you know, it's a very sophisticated worldview in a certain sense.
Did you run into any problems, by the way, with the title The Philosopher's Stone in England? Because isn't that the Harry Potter books that we understand here in this country as the Sorcerer's Stone? Wasn't that the Philosopher's Stone in England?
Yeah, it was. And no, I haven't had any complications about the title. And the reason why is that my book came out with a plural version. In other words, the term philosophers there is plural possessive. It's not apostrophe S, it's S apostrophe. So I was kind of clever on that sense because I did think, you know, when I was writing the book that I better not use anything that could be confused with Harry Potter because this is not a work of fiction.
Well, or not to mention how many 10-year-olds might accidentally get this book from Amazon.com for their birthday going, what? Grandma?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so what do we know of as being any of the ancient successes of alchemy? What were the alchemists actually capable of doing in the classic alchemical era?
Well, that's another intriguing question, and it's one I do spend some time with in the book, Ian, and I think it's an excellent question because, you know, I put it in the second chapter. I have a sentence that begins the chapter that the persisting problem with alchemy is precisely its persistence. In other words, you can go on the History Channel or so on and discover all these programs that denounce this idea as, you know, a pseudoscience. Well, the problem is that if it's a pseudoscience, it perdures and endures for hundreds of years, even into early modern times, the 17th and 18th century. And, you know, in that record, there are numerous occasions where alchemists claim that they have actually done it. One of the most interesting things that I mentioned in the book that just kind of floored me when I read it was that Charles XII of Sweden, you know, at the time that Sweden was a major world power, had a rather sophisticated royal court. Well, he had this general by the name of von Pichel that was condemned for treason and sentenced to death. And Pichel came to Charles and offered him a deal, basically, that I'll turn some base metals into gold for you. And, of course, Charles, being Charles, said, well, yeah, of course, but he decides that he's going to have a British artillery officer scrutinize this whole procedure. You know?
Right. So, at gunpoint.
At gunpoint, exactly. You know? So what happens is this Swedish general actually does this and supposedly transmutes a certain amount of base metal into gold, and Charles XII is suitably impressed with the whole operation. He's certified that, you know, he doesn't think it's fraudulent, and he actually has gold coins struck out of this stuff, Swedish krona, And, you know, this is one of numerous examples that you find in the historical record. So, you know, I think given the fact that we're dealing with something that endures that long, and the fact that we're dealing with basically rational people back then as well, that they wouldn't be doing this if on some cases they didn't have some success, and if on the other they didn't believe that there was an underlying physics involved in what they were doing, which they certainly over and over hint at that they certainly do think.
And an underlying physics here, I guess we could put that in quotes, in that they also saw it as being kind of a cross-discipline between science and mysticism.
Oh, yes, absolutely, and that's very well put, because one of the esoteric goals of alchemy is precisely the transmutation of the soul of the individual alchemist. In other words, the soul in its normal or natural or fallen state, however you wish to view it, they view as being sort of the base metal. And then when the alchemist achieves illumination, of course, he's transmuted that base metal into gold. And in some alchemists, it's very interesting that you have the idea that before they can transmute everyday average base metals like iron or tin into gold, that the alchemist himself has to be transformed in order to perform the operation. And again, you know, that has some very strange and peculiar parallels with modern physics. So it's a very strange story, but it's one that I think bears telling, and I think alchemy deserves a little bit of a second look, actually.
Well, and so, again, let's pull back a little bit before we go forward into the discussion of that relationship with modern physics. But, you know, some fairly famous people were alchemists, and they, and including perhaps, I mean, we could make an argument, even though we don't know of the completely verifiable life of Merlin, that Merlin would have been, as we understand it from Knights of the Round Table, that Merlin would have been an alchemist, and an unusual kind of alchemist, and that also gets into the whole religious thing, is could a Christian alchemist exist and be and be Orthodox at the same time? Did you have to be? There were lots of Jewish mystics that were also alchemists. Mm-hmm. So where does the religious piece fit into this?
Well, that to me was one of the most fascinating questions, and you know, you've read probably through the first couple chapters, and I do go into some of the theological connections there. The Western doctrine of the Trinity that begins to obtain in the Latin Church after the writing of St. Augustine of Hippo, whom I know you're very familiar with, is actually very peculiarly parallel to some of the thinking of the alchemists. So I have a bunch of texts in there that I actually cite where you can see these medieval alchemists, Christian alchemists, that are engaged in these operations, in these practices, and they will very strongly allude to that particular formulation of Trinitarian doctrine. And in one case, I even found a fellow that made the connection, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, to the alchemical conception of space, place, and motion.
Right, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is a very intriguing story. And the interesting thing, Ian, is the further back that you dig into these Neoplatonic and Hermetic metaphysical texts, if you read them in a particularly modern kind of mathematical, topological way, what immediately springs out at you, and this was kind of a discovery I made when I was over in England reading these things, what immediately jumps out at you is that the way that a theologian would have thought and the way that a modern mathematician thinks are oftentimes very, very similar.
Right.
So you get these texts, and all over the place you find all of these mathematical and topological metaphors just jumping off the page at you, and I was kind of amazed at that, and I tried to reproduce a few of those ideas in the book.
You know, there's a something what we discussed in previous shows, but it's something I learned in seminary once, that you can pretty much trace the God image of any given theologian back to their self image.
Yes.
So if they were, you know, if they were a lawyer by trade, God is a big, mighty lawyer with a big, booming voice who always wins their cases, right? And that no matter what whatever that theologian did or who they were, it defines on how they perceive God. And I think that that's also interesting because so many of these alchemists had to be walking some pretty fine lines.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
In order to stay within orthodoxy and not end up being killed. And so I would think that especially the way alchemy is often, you know, sort of spat out as kind of a dirty word during certain periods of Western history, that there must have been many alchemists who ended up, you know, burned at the stake or hanged or tortured, who also were probably trying desperately to prove that they could actually do what they said they could do in order to save their skins, but couldn't make cougar ants or couldn't make kroner, you know, coins.
Right, exactly. Well, I think this is quite true. And you also have a group, interestingly enough, of alchemists that are very well-known theologians. Albertus Magnus, of course, who was the instructor of Thomas Aquinas, was one of them, and he was certainly involved in alchemy. And you can even read alchemical passages in Thomas Aquinas himself.
Right,
you know,
right.
You get Roger Bacon and people like this, and you discover the interesting thing is that these are very famous, very sophisticated dogmatic theologians, and at the same time, they're alchemists. And the clue, I think, goes back to this idea of connection to the way that the Western Church had formulated Trinitarian doctrine, because it has some very direct parallels with a mathematical technique called topological triangulation. I mean, again, you know, the parallels to me are just kind of amazing.
So. No, that's so interesting. And no surprise then, too, to then push forward a little bit, is that the Nazis, who coveted so much of what the world had and wanted to take it and own it and absorb the power from it, you know, whether it's the Holy Grail, whether it's the Spear of Destiny, that they too would be attracted to the shortcut that is alchemy.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I'm so glad you raised that point, because in one of the final chapters of The Philosopher's Stone, I talk about the greater, what I call the Greater German Alchemical Reich, because many people make a point of drawing the connection between Nazism and its roots in occult secret societies and so on. But what most of them miss, Ian, and it kind of surprises me, is that alchemy was a kind of a popular hobby in between the wars inside of Germany. So you have a fellow by the name of General Erich Ludendorff, and for those who don't know who he is, he was the German general that was in charge of the last major German offensive during World War I. And he was a very, very early supporter of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi parties. And he was even a participant in the Beer Hall Putsch in Munich in 1923. Well, as Ludendorff's involved with the Nazis, at the same time, he gives a loan of 100,000 gold marks to a German alchemist by the name of Franz Tausend, who he has convinced the general that, you know, I'm an alchemist and I can make gold out of basically base metals. Well, this actually erupted into something of an international scandal, even. There were articles in the New York Times, there were articles in Time magazine at the time. This big scandal had gone to trial in Germany, and this alchemist had been tried for fraud. But the point here is, as you rightly point out, the Nazis were trying to take the shortcut. And I think one of the key reasons why is that they knew that there was some sort of physics basis behind this stuff. And the reason why they knew that is at the same time that this alchemist is saying all these things in Nazi Germany, you have serious scientific research being done in German firms like Siemens and so on and so forth. And what they're noticing, and there are articles I reproduce in my books, they're noticing that if under certain circumstances they stress mercury, they actually get little trace residues of gold that have come out of their experiments. So, yeah, it's a huge story.
Well, and let's get back to that, too. And we'll start to tie this all together, too, with modern physics and with the other research of Joseph Farrell into exotic matter. And what we mean by that, we'll get into a definition so it's easy enough to follow. But, boy, these books are so readable. So don't be at all dismayed by the fact that we're talking about some fairly specific hard sciences. It's not hard reading. The Philosopher's Stone, this latest from Joseph Farrell, will come back next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, again, I put the blog up earlier from some opening remarks on Coast to Coast for crypto news. I think you might enjoy tying together the latest research, oddly enough, going back to the conversation we just had, the latest scientific research about faith. And how it keeps kind of coming back to the idea that somehow being a person of faith makes you healthier. New research backing up both previous claims and pushing the ball forward on the subject as well. And you can read that at coasttocoastam.com. Just click onto my blog from there. And then there's some great crypto news stories from last night that might be fun to get caught up on. And you'd really enjoy, I think, the conversation we had if you have Streamlink. To go back and listen to Dr. Neil Tyson from last night talk about the planet Pluto, and then, you know, all of the other subjects that come up along the way, including Planet X and his reflections on the alignment of 2012. If you missed it, you listen to it through Streamlink. If you don't have Streamlink, it's worth the investment. You can get Coast to Coast on demand anytime. And this is a show that's going to be worth keeping, too. Let's continue the conversation coming up next with Joseph Farrell, The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy, and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. We'll talk more about that and all the different forms, not just the Nazi research on that, coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Joseph Farrell and I have been talking about the history of alchemy, and then no surprise that because the Nazi Third Reich was so morally bankrupt and they were afraid of being financially bankrupt as well, that they would even take what were sometimes intellectually bankrupt measures to try to bridge those two together. And that may explain, at least to some degree, their initial interest in alchemy. Is that it was a quick fix. If they could figure this out, and gosh darn it, if you know the Nazis didn't perceive themselves as the smartest people that had ever lived, if anybody could figure it out, it should be them, right?
Absolutely.
There was that great Aryan hubris if Jewish Kabbalists could do it in the Middle Ages, well, they could do it. So what were the Nazi moves? How did they begin to take serious alchemical research?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it goes directly to the question we left at before the break, and what is the physics basis for all of this, and how would we possibly explain it? I don't really pursue the normal angles that, you know, most people have when they pursue these types of subjects. I don't talk about dark matter or dark energy, because the key to this kind of physics, and again, I kind of take off here from Richard Hoagland. You know, he has that rule about the key to hyperdimensional physics is rotation, rotation, rotation. Well, the Nazis, interestingly enough, had several unified field theories that they could work with between the wars, one of them being that of a mathematician by the name of Theodor Kaluza. And basically, if you go into some of these theories, rotation is the key element. So I got to thinking, well, if the Nazis are going to do this, if they're really going to pursue this kind of physics, probably this is the way they're going to do it. And that's how I got into this Bell story. But basically, I think what they were investigating in is any exotic state of matter in a high spin state. And there's even a word for things like that. They're called isomers. And what isomers are is they are nuclear isotopes that exist in a very, very high state of spin. The nucleus is spinning wildly. But when they de-excite, they give off these enormous bursts of gamma rays, and they can even undergo spontaneous nuclear fission without neutron bombardment. You know, and that's been the classic model of nuclear fission up to this day. But they've recently discovered, there have been a number of scientific papers that I cite in the book, they've recently discovered that these elements can actually undergo transmutation simply by the whole idea of this high-speed rotation.
I'm going to slow you down because just sure. For people that don't have that, we are talking when we discuss the difference between transmutation then in that sense of something giving off energy as opposed
right.
to something conserving energy, which is, I'm assuming, what you're talking about.
Yeah, right. Exactly. The key here is, if you think about it in just simple physics terms, think of these high-speed nuclei as kind of an ice skater on an ice skating rink, and we're all familiar with what happens. As they draw their arms and legs in, they spin faster.
Right.
So, you know, what's going on with these isomers is exactly that. Most of that energy is being locked up in the angular momentum of the nucleus. But when it reaches a certain state in this spin, that nucleus will start to undergo some very interesting changes in its shape. And as a result of these changes, these odd nuclei clusters, they're now called, can actually split apart and transmute. And I think this is really what the Nazis, and even to get back to the alchemists for a moment, the alchemists were interested in extremely high heat and stressing the material that they worked with. So I think under certain conditions, yeah, they may have discovered some anomalies that led to similar types of transmutations.
Because well, I want you to use that metaphor, the skating metaphor. What would happen to the skater then if the skater were transmuted?
Well, if we assume that we can rotate that skater to extremely high speed,
right,
he would gradually increasingly flatten, but he would flatten around clumps of his body mass. So you'd have the head, the body, and so on and so forth. And at some point, the head and the body would simply fly apart. And that's basically what we see happening with these nuclear isomers. They basically kind of fly apart. And then the smaller chunks then, of course, are new elements. They transmute. So it's kind of an interesting area of physics. It really even opened up in only the last 20 years if you read some of these papers.
Well, okay, and again, I'm just for people who don't ordinarily follow science, so that skater spins so fast,
yep,
that certain body parts fly off,
yeah,
but then what's left becomes a new form of matter, becomes a
yeah,
new skater.
Yeah.
Right? It becomes a shorter, obviously, or funnier looking skater.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So what happens to the discarded parts?
Well, nothing is really lost in terms of the material. Again, you know, if you're going to split a nucleus into two different elements, you're going to get one element and then you're going to get another. That's essentially what's happening with our skater. He's going to lose certain body parts, but, you know, the body parts are still going to be there, but they're just not going to be the same recognizable skater. And it's the same thing with these isomers. You're not going to get the same recognizable elements that you started out with. It's a fascinating area of study, and one of the most interesting things, Ian, that I ran across, I found some scientific paper. I don't even remember what the name of it is right now. But they were doing this with some isomers in the platinum metals group. And they discovered that this isomer had a tendency to gate energy into itself at 39 divided by 2 rotations. And then it would gate energy out of the nucleus at precisely 22 rotations. So, you know, again, that's kind of an odd sort of numerical
right,
confirmation of some of the tetrahedral views that Mr. Hoagland's been working with for a number of years. But these isomers, again, I think are the key to what the Nazis are after in their kind of alchemical physical pursuits.
But in doing this, and uh-huh, this is to use the skater analogy one more time,
sure,
they're not the nuclear fission part of that metaphor would be that the skater with enough downward pressure to pull apart,
uh-huh,
that the skater would then the skater parts would fly off into other skaters, which would then also fly off into other skaters, which would fly off into other skaters.
They could, but the model that you're kind of using there is the idea of a standard neutron bombardment. But what happens
right,
with these isomers when they fission is you get a whole nucleus flying apart. That's
okay,
the difference.
All right.
In some very, very few cases, they've noticed that you do get free neutrons going on, and you know, they will be capable of fission if they're fast enough.
Right.
But this is a totally different model of nuclear fission than what we've been used to thus far.
Good. And I like that. I just want to make sure that people have a way of kind of having a handy handle on this.
Right.
So in the transmutation part of alchemy,
mm-hmm,
let's say we take Scott Hamilton as the skater, that you get a funnier, shorter looking version of Scott Hamilton, it's not really Scott Hamilton from before. And so that's the transmutation. You've got something else.
Right. Right.
Than what you had before.
Right.
But it's semi-recognizable.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Right. It's still chemically analyzable before it fissions. It's still chemically analyzable as the same element. But
right,
what is unique about it is it has this very, very odd shape. Like you say, it's recognizable. It's still Scott Hamilton, but Scott Hamilton stretched or squished in a very odd way.
Right. And I don't know that you can actually make Scott Hamilton any funnier looking than he is. So, to be totally honest about that. All right. So this is really key because this is the part of alchemy. The idea then of being able to do this. It sounds so simple to do, and we can do it in some respects. But the key is, can you control the outcome and produce something through that transmutation that you actually want?
Oh, yes, I think you can. And I think that this is really kind of one of the keys to what the Germans are up to here, because one of the fellows, oddly enough, that's involved with this Bell project, which, again, is a project involving high-speed rotation, is a Nobel laureate physicist by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach. Now, Gerlach, interestingly enough, wrote an article, I reproduce this in the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, for the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung in 1924. And it's just kind of a little column filler article. But what he says there is that, you know, they've got all these experiments in Germany going on where they've noticed they get traces of mercury as residue if they pulse mercury strong enough electrically, okay? And he writes a little article, and he says, well, it begins to look like there is a scientific possibility of a real alchemy, of a real kind of transmutation. And this would be certainly something worth investigating, and, you know, that's kind of a typical scientist plea for more money from the government.
So exactly.
Go off and do exactly that.
But, some things don't change no matter the regime.
That's right, you know. So you've got all of this stuff going on in Germany, and a Nobel laureate to boot kind of chiming in and saying, yeah, well, let's go do this, you know. And again, Gerlach is an interesting fellow because precisely his whole specialty in physics is this whole area of high-speed rotation, rotating magnetic fields, and so on and so forth. So it's a fascinating story.
All right. So I think a lot of people listening anyway will know about the Bell experiment, the Nazi Bell experiment. And I know you gave even a short thumbnail version of that, but unpack that a little bit more so people understand what that Bell experiment is, because I think we'll get back to it a few times tonight.
Sure. Well, in brief, the Bell was Nazi Germany's most highly classified research project. It was classified Kriegsentscheidend or war decisive. And I happen to be one of those people that believes that the Nazi atom bomb project was actually successful. So that classification gives you an idea that if the atom bomb, which they're certainly pursuing, is not even worthy of that kind of classification, just what the Bell really is. You know, in their eyes, it is the decisive secret weapons project. But basically, inside this device, it's bell-shaped. It stands about 15 feet tall. And there are two counter-rotating drums, which I argue a case for in one of my books, are stacked one on top of the other. And inside these drums, they put a special serum, it's codenamed Serum 525, in the literature. And it's most likely made out of mercury and thorium. My friend Igor Vitkovsky that broke the story, and then Nick Cook has talked about it in his book. One of the elements in this serum was precisely thorium in some sort of amalgamation with mercury. Now, thorium is interesting here, Ian, because there does exist an isomer, thorium-229, in one of these high-speed spin states. The interesting thing about thorium-229 isomer is that its threshold of de-excitation, in other words, where it will fission and give off all this energy and so on and so forth, is very low. Now, I find that interesting because when the Allied teams went into Nazi Germany after the end of the war and were kind of prowling around looking for all the secrets of their nuclear project, one of the things that we just could not figure out was why the Nazis had stockpiled massive amounts of thorium. You know, you'd think plutonium or uranium-235 would be on their top list. Well, no, it was thorium, of all things. And I happen to think it's precisely because in that high-speed spin state that they were investigating with the Bell, it functioned for them both kind of as a fuel for the device and also as a measurement device because, as you know, radioactive isotopes decay at a certain rate of time. Well, if you are in a high-spin state and you're playing around with the fabric of space-time, and we're back to that alchemical idea of a transmutative medium, then one of the ways that you could accurately measure the degree of time displacements that you're getting is by changes in the rates of radioactive decay. So, yeah, I think, you know, what the Nazis were doing with this Bell device was precisely this kind of alchemical high-spin hyper-dimensional physics, if you want to call it that.
And the intent of the Bell project was to generate what?
Well, I think it had basically three purposes. If you look at the SS departments that are actually in charge of this particular project, one of them is called the Forschung, Entwicklung und Patente, and the other is called the SS Entwicklungsstelle 4, and Development Area 4. The mission brief of these departments, Ian, was basically to make Germany energy independent, to investigate so-called free energy or zero-point energy.
Right.
So, in other words, this is a top-secret mission brief, and I think what the Nazis were after with this device then was a prototype technology that they could use to investigate three avenues of application. And they are for free energy, and secondly for a field propulsion device of some sort, in other words, an advanced sort of UFO, or if you will, a flying saucer. And the third thing, of course, is that they want to weaponize this physics. And any time, I want to stress this very heavily, any time you're in a possession of a technology that can engineer the fabric of space-time itself directly, then you have a weaponization potential that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So that's why the Nazis have placed this extremely high classification on it.
And who were the – did the scientists – that were making the claims of the possibilities for these either weapons or for these power sources, did they have the ethos to be able to make these claims? Were they that good, or were they just, you know, like dancing as fast as they could to keep the money coming and making promises that they hoped they could deliver on, but if they couldn't, at least it kept them out of the Russian front?
Well, I think in a certain sense, Ian, that they were that good. And the reason why is if we get into the Bell story a bit further, there are some very interesting stories from the concentration camp inmates at Gross Rosen that were close to the facilities where the Bell was tested at. And these inmates, of course, were used in the project. And they record, most of them being Polish, they record seeing barrel-like devices, you know, glowing a pale blue glow, ascending and descending the tree lines at night in this particular area of Germany. So it's a very bizarre and very long story. That's why it took five books to tell.
Right.
But
very interesting. And so, I mean, that part cannot be underemphasized, that at least to surviving eyewitnesses, there was some early, there were preliminary results which would have given them hope that they would have been able to rip the space-time continuum at their pleasure and to their advantage on the battlefield.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And here again, I want to stress something very interesting in connection with your observation, because the medical effects of this device were very, very extreme. The first time the Germans actually tested it, seven of the scientists involved in the test actually died. So subsequently, when they were testing this device, they actually broke the project into two parts, and there was a medical component to it to try and investigate how they could limit the field effects of this thing when it was actually being run. No. So what we're dealing with here, I want to emphasize, is a prototype technology. We're not at the stage of a practical craft, as it were, you know, that human beings can enter and then fly around.
Well, hang on for that. We'll come back to more of that. We'll leave it right there. The scientists break that up into two groups, the scientists and then the interns that actually do the testing. The Philosopher's Stone, Alchemy, and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Let's talk more about that exotic matter part, too, coming up next with Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.